Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Pensions Experts Fortnightly Podcast. On the show this week, the government's proposal to raise the normal minimum pensions age has been roundly slated by the pensions industry, the reason being that under the proposals in their current form, it is almost impossible to know for whom the age has in fact been raised and to which of their pension pots it applies. It's been branded a hugely complex mess. There have been calls for the whole thing to be scrapped or at least paused until such a time as somebody sensible can come in and rewrite it sensibly. We'll ask what's gone wrong, what needs to be done to fix it. Next up, the pensions regulator and the Financial Conduct Authority are in the mood to do things, and that does tend to bring this reporter out in a cold sweat. They've published a discussion document fleshing out their ideas for a new DC-wide value for money framework. Since they've said many of the precise details will have to be worked out by the industry, we'll ask our industry experts to work out the details for us. And then finally, movies and music are currently awash with 1980s nostalgia. And now the economy is having its own Stranger Things moment. Inflation has surged past the Bank of England's target, jumping from 2% in July to 3.2% last month, with the expectation being that further rises are on the way. Inflation did at least peak early in the 80s and then come down. So we'll ask whether that's likely to happen again and what the impact on pension schemes will be either way. I'm Benjamin Mercer, reporter at Pensions Expert. I'm joined today by Linda Whitney, partner at Aon, and by Stuart Earle, partner at Eversheds Sutherland. Thank you both very much for joining me. And we will begin with the normal minimum pension age. This reporter is keenly aware that should inflation not prove transitory, the higher the NMPA goes, the less likely he is to have any money left when he reaches it. But the various protections included have caused quite a lot of fuss. There's draft legislation which gives individuals the opportunity to join a pension scheme by April the 5th, 2023. But the scheme rules on February the 11th, 2023 already state that the member has an unqualified right to take pension benefits below the age of 57. They have then the unqualified right to take pension benefits below the age of 57. The Treasury did extend this as well after parts of the industry criticised the initial proposal that members should keep their protected pension age on a block transfer, but not individual transfers. This means, of course, the NMPA rise doesn't apply equally to everyone or to all of their pension pots, and that's been heavily criticised by the pensions industry, who have called, as I say, for some of it to be scrapped or at least postponed. I think we will kick off here with Linda, if you don't mind. That's a very broad sort of sketching out of the very confusing protections that are in place. How exactly does this work and why does it not work?
I'm going to go back in time a little bit here to 2010, when we first raised the minimum pension age from 50 to 55. So to some extent, we have lived through this before, of seeing people who had a protected minimum pension age in a set of scheme rules that enabled them to maintain that position. And you've also got to remember the reality of how many people can actually afford to retire at these very early ages in any case. The government's aim was to try and keep a normal minimum pension age that was broadly 10 years before state pension age. So the proposal to push it up again from 55 to 57 would be in line with that. So it's not so much the objective that I think the industry is struggling with, but the detail of the implementation. You could have put it in very strictly and applied it uniformly, and that would have created a number of losers. What they have instead done is created something that is relatively flexible, but incredibly complicated, leaving people with uncertainty about what their personal situation is for individual pots.
Yeah, I think that's right, Linda. And I think to come back to the point about reliving the 80s, we're seeing a lot of remakes of movies. And I think what's happened here is there's been a remake of the protections from 2006 and into 2010, and almost an attempt to lift and drop a lot of those protections without recognising that the industry has changed significantly since 2010. There's greater flexibility in accessing benefits. And so to your point, Linda, whilst people probably can't afford to retire at 55 or indeed 57, the temptation to be able to dip into some of their pot and actually start taking some lump sums and tax advantages of doing so is there now when it wasn't there 10, 11 years ago. And we are in an unholy mess, or we're looking at an unholy mess where an individual could potentially have a minimum pension age of 50 in one pot, 55 in one pot and 57 in another. And I pity and have absolute sympathy for the scheme administrators that are going to have to pick this up. Very simple example, you get an individual who transfers from from one pot to another, they take it on an individual basis. All of a sudden, they've got one pot within that new scheme, which they can take at 55, and the rest of it at 57. And that 55 pot has going to have to be ring-fenced, administered separately. It was bad enough trying to communicate this to members back in 2010. I fear it's going to be even harder this time around.
I'm cognizant of Linda's point that the strict application of such a change would have created some losers. It does sound as though the uncertainty will create losers as well. Is there a way in which the change could be affected without creating losers, or is it just a case of finding the way forward which makes the fewest people lose out? And in which case, would a strict application of the rule without all of these protections be better, despite the good intentions of including these protections? Linda, do you want to come in on that?
Yes, I think it's a tricky area because, as I say, it's a bit of a balance between creating something that's so complex that people don't understand it, or creating something that's very simple but actually could have adverse consequences for the minority of people who would otherwise be able to retire between 55 and 57 and potentially have, you know, built their plans around that. So I just think it's a really tough decision here in terms of how we create these situations. I think part of the complexity is coming from the fact that the deadlines are in the future, whereas I think previously when arrangements like this have been brought in, the deadlines have always been introduced sort of immediately or in the immediate past, so that you didn't get this collection of people who in theory could do something in order to get into a scheme and get a new bit of protection. And that's where one of the additional areas of complexity comes from this time.
And Stuart, well, one of the other concerns, or some of the other concerns that have been raised, are that the protections as they currently exist would actually create incentives that run contrary to other aspects of government policy. So for instance, if a small pot still exists, which enjoys the protected benefits for an earlier normal minimum pension age, there will be less of an incentive perhaps to consolidate that small pot. People will be more keen to keep it if they know that the earlier, the easier, the nicer rules for them still apply to it. Is that a significant or a principal concern? I mean, how contradictory are the incentives created by this proposed change?
Yeah, it's a fair observation, and it doesn't make consolidation any easier and perhaps less attractive for individuals if they're doing this on their own, off their own bat. You know, if they're part of a bulk transfer from one scheme to a master trust, for example, there's greater chance that their minimum pension age of 55 will be retained, and that's helpful. But if an individual themselves are looking to consolidate and bring their pots together, it's going to be harder to ensure that they can maintain that age of 55. Because I said earlier, you know, they could end up with a position where they've got one pot at 55 and the rest at 57. They could potentially lose out altogether. And we do have a problems with the regulations at the moment that anybody who looks to make a transfer before April 2023 could lose their minimum pension age of 55 altogether, and all of a sudden find that their entire pot is pegged to 57. Those sort of communications, those sort of issues need to be writ large and thrashed out and made aware to individuals before they make a decision over the next, you know, 18 months or so, if the regulations aren't tweaked. If a member makes a decision now, which they'll regret when they get to 55 and think they can take their pot, but unfortunately can't.
And I think that's a really good point, Stuart, which is around how we communicate and advertise just the broad change, forget the details, but the broad change of a normal minimum pension age moving from 55 to 57. So we do have to get out there as an industry and as government to get across to people that pensions are there for your older age, and this sort of 10 years before state pension being a normal period to be taking it early, and people planning for, you know, 57 or later. And for most people, it will be later than that for their retirement.
Excellent. Just one more on this then, because obviously we've had these calls for it to be scrapped, for it to be changed in quite significant ways. If you were to give predictions for the future, I mean, would these calls be heeded? Do you anticipate there being changes made, either of you, to the proposals that they currently stand, or will the government be in sort of bloody-minded mode and press forward regardless? Linda, do you want to start with this one?
I think that's hard to tell, really. I don't have a strong view on this one as to whether we'll see movement or not.
I think we'll see tweaking to the way in which this will be implemented And I suppose we're more at the technical end there of implementation rather than it not going ahead altogether. There are points around, you know, somebody straddling April 2023, depending on whether they're 55 or 56, when their birthday is, how they can go about taking their benefits either side of that date. Things like that need to be worked through so that we don't have too much of an immediate cliff edge. But I don't anticipate that we'll see a material change in what's already out there.
Fair enough. Well, the positive of that, of course, is that the more mistakes are made in government policy, the more articles we get to write about it, and therefore the longer I stay employed. So I suppose it's good for someone. We will move on to value for money in that case. The Pensions Regulator and the Financial Conduct Authority's discussion document, as mentioned, proposes this new value for money framework. It outlines a framework that would force defined contribution schemes to disclose more data around their investment performance, their scheme oversight, costs and charges. The regulators are looking to create what they call an holistic framework for assessing value for money in this sector, as well as allowing members in the industry itself to compare costs and charges. The proposed framework would allow trustees and independent governance committees to assess investment performance and service standards, which are also deemed important in determining whether a particular scheme is delivering value for money. But there are concerns about transparency, and the regulators do seem to have left it to the industry to invent metrics by which things like customer service can be measured. So, Stuart, I'll kick off with you on this one. So far, the only way I've been able to determine about, you know, working out value for money from customer service is calling, I won't name a company, and then being very annoyed by their inability to solve my problem, and then determining I'm not getting value for money, for instance, for my internet service provider. How does this work, though, in practice, sort of broadly? I mean, I know the regulators have said it is for the industry to work these things out, I think. If you were to do some sort of back of the flag packet workings out for us, how would you devise such a system? Is it a sensible system to begin with?
I think the concept of value for money certainly needs focus, and the rationale behind this discussion document makes entire sense, so that it sort of drives performance of the providers and the trustees, particularly for a number of pension schemes which have been sort of left fallow. Investments are set and members have left them there and probably don't even know they are there. And in the meantime, pension accounts are being diminished by charges. How we actually go about doing this, and the discussion document talks about, you know, a real focus on investment metrics, investment performance, looking at customer experience, the communication and governance that is undertaken in respect of schemes, as well as good old-fashioned costs and charges. Now, the issue that I think, from my perspective, probably twofold. One is how you can set some metrics that are easily comparable across all of these schemes. It seems almost impossible. I mean, I'd defer to Linda with her background. Undoubtedly, we'll have a better angle on that. But it just seems there are so many different variations across schemes, whether it's a workplace scheme, a non-workplace scheme used for auto-enrollment, whether it's got default strategies, lifestyling strategies, whether they're old style with profits funds, guaranteed annuity rates, all of those are so different that they're trying to find a way that you can compare metrics and compare value for money is, for me, seems very, very difficult to achieve. And I suppose, secondly, this is just burdening schemes with yet more and more reporting requirements and analysis that needs to be undertaken. And look, you know, I just fear that sometimes we forget there's a pension to be provided at the end of this, and maybe that should be a focus. But, you know, maybe Linda's views on metrics will be more insightful than those of a lawyer.
Seems like a good moment to bring Linda in. Linda, what do you say?
I think it is sensible to be taking that initial objective of being able to compare a master trust and a GPP on a level playing field. So the direction that they're coming from in the pensions regulator and the FCA working together for a set of rules, I think is actually, you know, quite positive. Talking about those investment returns, absolutely. Investment returns are a really important driver of the member outcome. And recognizing the net return, the actual return that the member receives after charges, being the thing that drives that outcome. Absolutely, as Stuart says, there's lots of different types of investment. And what we really don't want to do is to lose innovation in the investment market by strict charge limits that actually drive down the ability to innovate rather than drive down the cost and therefore improve the overall member outcome. Because if you're getting, you know, a lower net return because you're getting lower inputs and lower costs, then that isn't actually driving a better outcome. In terms of the actual measurement and metrics of the investment returns, there's clearly quite a lot of work to be done. And I would support Stuart's question around, and how much does that work, particularly for smaller DC schemes? And so I think underlying this is this general direction of travel of actually smaller schemes being encouraged to look at their situation and encouraged to look at consolidation. But that isn't always the simplest thing to achieve. I've, you know, worked with trustees. We're sitting there looking at situations where actually they know it's not a great DC scheme that they're looking after, but actually finding somebody who wants to take that on is not necessarily straightforward. There are barriers to that as well.
I think that's absolutely right, that we've got a whole host of schemes out there sitting on probably billions of assets in total when you look at the number of smaller schemes that there are, for whom this is going to be almost impossible to achieve. And also, as you say, Linda, there's probably no home for them to go to. I mean, one further sort of observation I've got in terms of the discussion document, whilst helpful and the direction of travel makes a great deal of sense, it is clearly focused, and I think in the first couple of paragraphs, you know, unashamedly says this is focused on accumulation. And I think that misses the biggest point of all, in that accumulation is barely half of the problem. Because, yeah, you might be able to fix some costs and charges, and you might be able to shave, you know, a couple of basis points here and there. But the big deal is when somebody comes to take their pot at 55, 57, 65, or goodness knows what age, if they don't have a good product or an innovative product or a cost-effective value for money product at the end, when they're into that decumulation phase, the previous 30, 40 years would have been for naught. So I do think, as much as there is a focus on getting things right to encourage and to help savers and understanding what's there, if we take our eye off the ball for decumulation and don't have equal focus on that now, we're storing up a bigger problem, in my view.
Excellent. Well, I suppose that's something we will look forward to seeing that. But if it is a bigger problem being stored up, then we don't look forward to seeing it at all, do we? But we'll hope it doesn't happen. But that's certainly an interesting point. We will move on to our final topic of the day then, which is inflation. There is a little bit of good news here as well, which means that anyone who is sort of playing around with stocks and cryptocurrency can now afford to actually do quite badly with stocks and cryptocurrency and still end up at the end of the year better off than someone who left their money in a bank. So I think you've got about a 3% leeway for irresponsibility these days, which could go up to 4%. Not that that's investment advice in any conceivable way, but inflation, it's on the up. First time in my lifetime, actually, I think I get to do a story about inflation. Certain transient effects are expected to disappear from the figures in the relatively short term, like the impact of the government's Eat Out to Help Out scheme. But the ONS has cited a range of other impacts, including shortages of supply chain staff and increased shipping costs and demand increases following the lifting of national lockdowns. These continue to push up inflation. Not immediately clear at the moment as to how transitory these things are. So I suppose there are two questions here, and I'll begin with Linda on the first one. Some of the problems that are potentially being stored up for pension schemes depend on inflation lasting for quite a long time, don't they? So I suppose the logical first question is, do you expect inflation to linger, or is it going to be one of those sort of temporary phenomena? It's also the million-dollar question, which by the time you've answered it will be the £500,000 question.
Inflation, it's the moth that eats away at your savings. Absolutely. It's taking slightly larger bites at the moment, but whether that continues is in significant doubt. I think there's clearly a whole range of things that do put pressure on it over, you know, the next year or so. And we're seeing a lot of those in the news at the moment, but may not quite hit the September figures that are particularly key for pension increases for this year. Over the longer term, much harder to judge. There's lots of things going on, pressures in the industry in different directions as to where inflation will go after that. But I think in terms of this September's figures, which will be key for pension increases being provided next April, what we are likely to see is something that's perhaps just a shade lower than August. So hopefully, actually relatively straightforward for schemes. So the headline figure that you see in all the newspapers these days is CPIH, So this is CPI, including housing, which in August was 3%, and I think is expected to drop a little in September, probably. RPI up at 4.8 and CPI on its own without the housing bit of 3.2 in August. Particularly of interest in pension schemes if RPI goes over 5, because we have a lot of schemes that have discretionary increases above 5. So that one would set decisions running that schemes would need to make if it does go over 5 in September, although I think probably won't. And so some really quite sort of nuanced effects going on. And also, I think a lot in the news, and this was one I will hand definitely over to Stuart on, where schemes are still having those conversations about their scheme rules as to what is a definition of inflation that they can use for their particular benefits, and which schemes can move from RPI to either CPI or CPIH.
Yeah, the rules lottery continues, doesn't it? And nobody could have foretold the stroke of a pen, you know, 15, 20 plus years ago, and how much it would have had an impact on an individual member's level of increase now. And you're absolutely right. We're now sort of into that period of RPI, where RPI can still apply, is going to be really significant given the, you know, the potential increases and the wedge between RPI and CPI. And so that just brings ever greater focus on whether schemes can make the leap before 2030 from RPI to CPI. And I think these numbers, whilst, you know, it might be that, you know, the higher inflation is transient and won't be with us for too long, it will just bring to the focus of finance teams and treasury teams in sponsoring employers, say, well, actually, you know, if we can make that move sooner, it just takes out some of that risk as we run into the proposed change to RPI from 2030. The other point I was going to pick up, Linda, from what you were saying, agreeing up entirely with the point about discretions, but another issue which I've had calls to even think about as often as this week around discretionary increases is not even where RPI or exceeds 5%, but also for those members who built up benefits before 1997, where a large chunk of their pension is likely to be subject to discretionary increases anyway. Those members have seen the headlines, high inflation, and yet their pension won't get an increase. And I've already had a call from one chair of trustees who has been made aware that there's a group of pensioners who will be, you know, battening down the door to ask for a discretionary increase in light of the higher levels of inflation. So I think, you know, it's one for trustees to be focusing on from that perspective as well.
I think it's interesting when you look at DB schemes and how they've been managing inflation risk over the last few years. So for a lot of DB schemes, they have actually been hedging at least the guaranteed benefits, discretionary being a different issue. But where they've got guaranteed pension increases, we've seen liability-driven investment used and high inflation hedges. So even if inflation goes up, actually a lot of schemes have assets that will also go up and protect them in deficit terms from that. But for the smaller proportion of schemes who've still got new benefits accruing, the cost of those new benefits accruing goes up again as inflation goes up. So again, if you're talking about what a finance team's looking at, they'll be looking at that as well. And for DC members, well, they've often got the risk themselves, because, you know, there's a risk either if they're in drawdown or if they've bought fixed annuities that actually they are going to face the inflation on their own without any support. So I think the fact that DC members have for the last quite a number of years tended to buy products where they don't have inflation protection built in leaves that generation exposed to higher inflation much more so actually than the DB schemes who've been hedging out inflation risk.
Excellent. I think that brings us just about to the end of the programme. We've got time just about for always a pensions angle. And I think, Stuart, you're bringing that to us this week.
Yeah, it just proves that wherever you go and whatever you do, pensions is around the corner. And I was mentioning earlier that a few years back now, whilst enjoying a family holiday, my wife was heavily pregnant at the time and had one of those moments of a few twinges at 2 o'clock in the morning. So we did a mercy dash to a hospital in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the country. Had to basically knock the door down to get in, and were very, very well looked after. And it was only after an hour or so while I was chatting away to the doctor who was taking care of us that we realised that her father was actually a pensions partner at a firm who I'd been working with on a deal that week. And so we enjoyed a few moments exchanging the pleasantries of what it's like to be involved or have a connection to pensions. Meanwhile, my wife was reaching for the gas and air. But yeah, it doesn't matter where you go or wherever you end up, there's always pensions there.
Small world.
Very small world. I sort of hope that would conclude with the pensions are the equivalent of gas and air, in which case I was sitting in on a working pensions committee meeting earlier today talking about increasing access and opportunities to access pensions guidance. And it did suddenly, as you were saying, that story occurred to me. Maybe if pensions successfully calms down pregnant women at the moment of birth, just send in a pensions advisor and that will do the job. And you've solved two problems. But maybe that's not as tenable.
Maybe it was my delivery rather than the topic.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I think that does bring us to the end of the podcast. So thank you both to Stuart and to Linda very much for joining us. As ever, we will be back in 2 weeks' time. We hope to see you then.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. Allbirds.com, code FRESHSOCKS.